ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So today we'll examine a little bit the Bhagavad Gita as it is by Srila Prabhupada, and we're focusing on the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, text number 30. So we could all chant together. Sadi Bhutadi Daivang Mang Sadi Yagyang Chaye Vidu Prayana Kaleti Chamang Te Vidur Yukta Cheta Saha. Translation. Those in full consciousness of me, who know me, the Supreme Lord, to be the governing principle of the material manifestation, of the demigods, and of all the methods of sacrifice, can understand and know me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even at the time of death. Purport. Persons acting in Krishna consciousness are never deviated from the path of entirely understanding the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the transcendental association of Krishna consciousness, one can understand how the Supreme Lord is the governing principle of the material manifestation and even of the demigods. Gradually, by such transcendental association, one becomes convinced of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and at the time of death, such a Krishna-conscious person can never forget Krishna. Naturally, he is thus promoted to the planet of the Supreme Lord, Goloka Vrindavan. This 7th chapter particularly explains how one can become a fully Krishna-conscious person. The beginning of Krishna consciousness is the association of persons who are Krishna conscious. Such association is spiritual and puts one directly in touch with the Supreme Lord, and by His grace, one can understand Krishna to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. At the same time, one can really understand the constitutional position of the living entity and how the living entity forgets Krishna and becomes entangled in material activities. Actually, that might not be quite so easy to understand. However, by gradual development of Krishna consciousness in good association, the living entity can understand that due to forgetfulness of Krishna, he has become conditioned by the laws of material nature. He can also understand that this human form of life is an opportunity to regain Krishna consciousness, and that it should be fully utilized to attain the causeless mercy of the Supreme Lord. Many subjects have been discussed in this chapter. The man in distress, the inquisitive man, the man in want of material necessities, knowledge of Brahman, knowledge of Paramatma, liberation from birth, death, and diseases, and worship of the Supreme Lord. However, he who is actually elevated in Krishna consciousness does not care for the different processes. He simply directly engages himself in activities of Krishna consciousness and thereby factually attains his constitutional position as an eternal servitor of Lord Krishna. In such a situation, he takes pleasure in hearing and glorifying the Supreme Lord in pure devotional service. He is convinced that by his doing so, all his objectives will be fulfilled. This determined faith is called Dridha Vrata, and it is the beginning of Bhakti Yoga, or transcendental loving service. That is the verdict of all scriptures, and this 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is the substance of that conviction. Omagyana timirandhasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. So this chapter 7 is distinguished, in my humble realization, as the beginning of Krishna explaining his personality. This, the term that is used in Sanskrit is aham, I. This is the verse where Krishna really gets into the I principle of who he is. If you examine previous chapters, there are references that Krishna makes to himself. Right in the beginning of chapter 2, Krishna explains, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings here present. So Krishna is explaining the eternality of the individual soul rather than his own eternality in that verse, although it is mentioned. The next time that Krishna mentions the aham word of I is in the third chapter, where he's explaining to Arjuna Krishna consciousness in karma yoga, and he's explaining that I also have duties to perform. I also have to perform things. Because if I didn't, this would be a very bad example for everyone else. And whoever is a leader has to set the example. So in this way, in the third chapter, Krishna mentions that, you know, I, who I am, to some degree. And then in the fourth chapter, Krishna again gives this explanation of who he is, said whenever there is a decline in religion and religious understanding, at that time I descend myself. And he also explains that I was the one who first gave the knowledge of yoga to the sun god, Vivasvan, and then Vivasvan passed it on to Ikshvaku and so on in this line of disciplic succession. And so in this way, Arjuna asks, well, how is it that you're only kind of, we're actually the same age, so how is it that you gave the knowledge of yoga to the sun god? And then Krishna explains, well, many, many births both you and I have had, but I remember all of them, but you don't. You're subject to forgetfulness, but I'm not. And so this is another inkling of who Krishna is and what he is. So, but in this particular chapter, in chapter 6, after Krishna has explained the very the systems of yoga, jnana yoga, karma yoga, dhyana yoga, and there was an interesting description of what is actually yoga. And there was a nice definition given that yoga is that which prepares one for meeting with God. It's a good definition of yoga. How do you meet with God? How do you prepare yourself to meet with God? And so that's this description. So those descriptions of these different kinds of yoga, the jnana yoga, the karma yoga, and dhyana yoga, which is meditation, the meditational practice of yoga, these are preparations for meeting with God. So those Krishna has given. Of course, later on he comes to bhakti yoga, but first he has some explaining to do regarding himself, who he is, and why bhakti yoga is relevant and the highest form of yoga. So in this seventh chapter, Krishna begins, he starts off, now hear from me how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with your mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free from doubt. This question of being free from doubt is very important, because that's Arjuna's original problem, that he has these doubts that what he's about to do, what the battle that he's about to undertake, is going to be a very difficult thing for him to do, and is it worth it? What's the point? And so he has these doubts. So Krishna now says, now I will free you from doubt. Asamshayam is the word that he uses, and he continues that. Once I tell you, by explaining this to you, you will have nothing further to know. There's nothing further to be explained in this material world once you've understood what I'm going to tell you now. This is a very, you could say, astounding claim, that I could tell you something that once you know that, you don't need to know anything further, whether it's material or spiritual or whatever. But of course, Krishna is referring to the spiritual, that once you know this, there's nothing further. This is it. And so he begins, interestingly, by examining the fact that many, many people who have attempted to find perfection, they and even some who have found the perfection of their lives, do not really know me in truth. So that's also a very telling proposition, that how is it that that people who even attain perfection don't really know Krishna? That comes later on. And so then after this, Krishna explains, he starts right at the beginning from the material energy. The material energy consists of 8 different elements, and these elements are my separated material energy, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. These are my 8 separated material energies. And then one of the most crucial verses is verse 5, in which Krishna explains, Apareyam itastvanyam prakritim virime param jiva bhuta mahabaho yayedam dharyate jagat. That apart from this material energy, apart from this apara, para means superior, and apara means inferior. So apart from this inferior energy of all these material elements, there is a superior energy of mine, Krishna says, and this superior energy is jiva bhuta, the living entities, the separated living entities. Krishna only uses this word jiva at 3 occasions in the Bhagavad Gita, in the text of the Bhagavad Gita itself. Of course, we understand that the commentaries have many different descriptions of what the jiva is and how he is. And it's this jiva, that is where the spiritual energy takes up a material form, takes a material body. It's a living, the various living entities. So this is, there are many other words that Krishna uses for a body, for the material body. Dehi nosmin yata dehe, that's the verse in the 2nd chapter. So dehi is one of those. And the other one is one of our favorite words from one of our favorite bhajans, sharira. Sharira avidya jal. So this sharira, this is also a word that Krishna uses for the word body. But these terms of the body do not, dehi and sharira, they don't include that spiritual principle of jiva, jiva bhuta. So the next time we encounter the word jiva, interestingly enough, is also in this verse, where Krishna says, jivanam sarva bhutanam. Jiva sarva bhutanam means all living entities. And Krishna says, jivanam sarva bhutanam. I am the life in all living entities. And then the third occasion where Krishna uses this word jiva is in the 15th chapter, where Krishna says, mamaivangso jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. So here he's saying that my parts and parcels, there are individual parts of me, jiva loka, that live in the place of the jivas, and jiva bhuta, these are the living entities that are associated with me spiritually, that they are spiritual living entities. So these are really the only areas where Krishna explains this term jiva, jiva bhuta sanatana. And he says in the 15th chapter, manakshashtanindriyani prakriti stani karshati, that these living entities, these jiva bhutas, they're struggling. Karshati. Karshati is the same word that comes from karma. It's the active word of karma. So karshati, they are struggling with their 6 senses, the 5 different senses, and the mind. The mind is considered the sixth sense. So this, in a sense, harks back to the seventh chapter where Krishna explains the five different material elements of earth, water, fire, air, ether. And so in the same way, he says, with the mind as the sixth sense, people in this material world struggle with these material elements. That is the nature of being Jiva Bhuta. And so this is the beginning of the seventh chapter. And Krishna continues in the seventh chapter, Etad Yonini Bhutani Sarvanityupadharaya. And he says, all living entities have their birth in me. Their yoni. And prabhava pralaya tata. They have their coming into being, prabhava. We know this word bhava. Bhava means to come into being. So their prabhava means the beginning of their coming into being. That beginning, and pralaya means the destruction, the end of the universe, prabhava pralaya tata. They all have their beginning and their end in me. They have their coming into being, their birth and their death. And then Krishna says, indeed, everything in this material world, there is nothing superior to me, that everything rests on me. As pearls are strung upon a thread. So we see that these Jiva Bhutas, we are like a part of the thread on which these pearls are strung. And we are in that sense part of Krishna. We are part of the thread because that is our. And then Krishna becomes very eye-centered. He says, I am the light of the sun and the moon. I am the syllable Om in the Vedic mantras. I am the sound in ether. As I said, I am the ability in man. I am the life of all that lives. I am the essence and fragrance of the earth. I am the seed-giving father. All these things, Krishna says, aham, I am. And so that's really the beginning of the significance of understanding who is the personality of Godhead. That's the thing. And so this seventh verse continues and branches off from that, and it describes, for example, who are the people who want to accept Krishna, who want to become Krishna conscious, or who want something that they realize that they are in this world powerless. They aren't the masters of their own destiny. They are not Ishvara. So as I was saying, that the word Jiva Bhuta, that only occurs about 3 times in Bhagavad Gita. The word Ishvara occurs about 15. I looked it up. Went through it, you know, quote by quote to see, and it's about 15 times in the text where Krishna refers to himself as Ishvara, sometimes as Maheshvara, Maha Ishvara, the great controller, sometimes as Yoga Ishvara, the master of yoga and yoga practices. So in this way, the word Ishvara happens quite frequently in Bhagavad Gita, and Krishna is describing his essence as his being as the controller of this material energy. And so then he describes people who understand that they are not the controller. They approach Krishna for different reasons. People approach Krishna out of need, that they are in material distress. So they will pray to Krishna, please, Krishna, we need food on the table, or we need this, or we need that. People who are in material distress. People who want things from Krishna. People who also are curious. One sees the great philosophers of the world. People who are absorbed in the mental speculation. They understand that they are not the controller, or they are bewildered, or they would like to be the controller, And so they engage in trying to find out who Krishna is and what their situation is. So these are the kinds of people that approach Krishna. And Krishna also explains the people who don't approach Krishna, that the people who are mudhas, who are strictly engaged in heavy material activities for their own sense gratification. Because they do not understand that sense gratification, it's an endless path with no real reward. The rewards are very, very temporary. So the mudha class, and then we have the next class, which are the mayaya parita jnanas, the people whose knowledge is stolen by illusion. This is largely the class of speculators who wish to deny God. There are a lot of scientists who fall into this category. They practice what is called scientism, but that's a whole other class. And I'll leave that to more qualified people. These are scientists who, in an attempt to disprove Krishna, in an attempt to promote atheism, they will speculate on different theories of Big Bang is an atheistic one. Those are called mayaya parita jnana. Then there is another class of men, naradham. Naradhamas, they're an interesting class, who have some material advantages, but have their material situation, and it's a curious, I often wonder, I often think of my parents in this way, because they had no interest at all in spiritual life. Kind of people, and they would go lawn bowling on Saturday and Sunday afternoon. Radam, that there's no real redeeming spiritual quality. And finally, of course, the asuras who are very much against any form of God, any understanding of God. And so you have the description of I am wealthy and I am powerful and I shall give in the demonic mentality. So in this way, Krishna explains the different people. The people who worship demigods. People who worship demigods are kind of a higher list of mudha, you might say, because they do understand that there are higher ingratiate themselves with us, and thereby these higher powers will give them whatever powers and whatever benefits can be attained on the material platform. So these people go to the heavenly planet. Krishna explains, seventh chapter, for those of us who are embodied, and we do understand that having reminders of our God brothers now who are reaching that age where it seems like quite, and so it's explaining where you go at the time of death depending on what you worship in this life. So people who worship the demigods, they go to the planets of the demigods. People who worship the power, especially in the political area, in the sports area, in the entertainment industry, people are worshiping these people. They're completely focused on this particular pop singer, or this particular sports team, or this particular politician who seems to be doing well or poorly, however you assess it. And so these people, they take birth in this material world again, because that is what they worship, that is what they want. And then finally, those who worship ghosts and spirits, they take birth among such beings, it's described. And we don't have too much of that in the West, but certainly in places like in Africa where I grew up, there's a lot of worship of strange things that go on. things that go bump in the night, as the poet once called it. You know. So these people, they take birth among such beings. And one sees it a little bit in the West, people who are into witchcraft and worshiping some sort of the more demoniac elements on the ethereal platform. So Krishna explains this. And then he explains that those who worship us should not be condemned. Actually, by worshiping the demigods and by becoming fixed in this worship, they will actually attain to him, because after a while they will understand that all these benefits that they're getting from the demigods, ostensibly from the demigods, are coming from him personally. He's actually the person who is giving out these benefits that the demigods are in charge of and that the demigods dispense. So in that way, one shouldn't really condemn people who are fixed on a path. One should try to enlighten them, obviously, and we do that. We do a lot of preaching to people who are demigod worshippers in some way or another. It's especially there's description of one devotee was saying in India how they were taking prasadam with Srila Prabhupada, and so the devotee asked, you know, Srila Prabhupada, this life member, he has lots of gods on his altar, you know, is that okay, you know? What, and we're taking, and they're, the prasadam he's offering, and for him it's all the same, whether it's Krishna or Shiva or Durga or whatever, you know, why should we, how should we understand this? And Prabhupada says, we can understand that it is prasadam. We can understand that actually it is all prasadam, but we focus on offering our prasadam to Krishna, and that is our understanding, that if Krishna says this, that whatever we offer, whatever we give away, whatever should be done as an offering to him. So that's an interesting sidelight. So we do preach to devotees who are worshippers of demigods, because the demigod worship is considered to be in the mode of goodness. And it is from the platform of the mode of goodness that actually we can understand spiritual truth, we can understand spiritual jnana and understanding. We can come to spiritual understanding. So, if I can go back to here. All right. So, then if we look at this verse again, text 30, what, is it possible to put the Sanskrit up there? So, the Adibhuta, Adidaivam, Adiyagya. Those three terms is in the next chapter, what Arjuna asks Krishna to explain. What is Adibhuta? What is Adidaiva? What is Adiyagya? Those three things Arjuna wants Krishna to explain once. And also he wants Krishna to explain Prayana Kale, that is what happens at the time of death. And so this is the follow-on to the next chapter. This chapter in particular doesn't begin with Arjuna's questions. This chapter begins after Krishna has dealt with all the different types of yoga. And then Krishna says, now I'm going to tell you this. So then having told Arjuna these things, then Arjuna asks these questions. And the eighth chapter is called Attaining the Supreme. How to reach the supreme destination. And so that's a verse for another class. So I would like to know if, thank you very much for your attention. Are there any questions or additions? Yes. Is there the mic is there? Very good.
Thank you. Thank you for a wonderful, wonderful class. I'm just wondering, you mentioned everything but the ancestors, so Krishna also speaks in that chapter, I think, of worship of ancestors, people who worship ancestors.
Oh, people who worship ancestors, that's right. I somehow missed them in the class. People who worship ancestors. This is not really a common practice in the West, so it's not something that we are focused on. But in India it is very much. One can see that the closest we come in the West is the fourth commandment, I think it is, honor thy father and mother. That is in the Judeo-Christian tradition. So in that way one worships father and mother. But in India this is very prominent, and there are offerings made to Vishnu, and these offerings are called pinda. Offerings are made to Vishnu, and then these offerings then go to the forefathers who have passed away. And in this way, the forefathers, because India is pious, and generally they will have worshipped demigods in their lives. So therefore, whatever benefits they got, whatever heavenly planet they go to, then they are maintained in that status, in that Pitri Loka, which is considered a heavenly planet, for a long time. For as long as those offerings are kept up, as long as those offerings are made, then your forefathers get to be in the heavenly planets. Once they stop, it's back down again. That's the unfortunate thing about the material world. It's always, there was one other lady there. I'm sorry, sir.
What if one makes an offering and forgets for a couple of years?
that goes in, if what happens if one makes the offering and then one forgets for a few years and then offers again, you know, that is something that we say the super soul takes care of those circumstances. The bottom atma. Yes.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Of the four types of people that you said come to Krishna, two of them, the inquisitive and the seeker of knowledge. Could you please explain?
The inquisitive, how does it, Gyani Chabara Tarshu? Oh, there's one who is in knowledge. It's not, one is the seeker, the curious, and one who is in knowledge. That's the difference between the two. As explained in the seventh chapter, in this 7:16, I think it is.
So, who is in knowledge but not incomplete?
Well, that's a good question. Is because Krishna explains that in the 19th verse of this chapter, where he's bahunam jamanam ante gyanavan mam prapadyante vasudeva sarvamiti samahatma sudurlaba. So he explains that. Bahunam, Jananam, many, many people, Jnanavan, who are in knowledge, finally they surrender to me. To be in knowledge doesn't necessarily mean that you are surrendered to Krishna. So one who finally, after many, many births, is in knowledge, he will surrender to me because he knows me to be all that is, the superior and all that is. So it's a little bit baffling actually how Krishna uses this term Jnanavan, one who is in knowledge, and yet such a person is not already a devotee. That's the conundrum here, you might say. That how does that work exactly? And I don't really have a good answer, as good an answer as I would like to have, put it that way. Good.
I think from my understanding, from what I've heard, that they are in knowledge of Brahman, but they don't have the complete picture of Paramatma and Bhagavan.
Yes. So Jnanis, their ultimate goal, we are told, is Brahman, where they understand, one could say, almost say in a pantheistic way, they understand that everything has to be Brahman, everything has to be part of part of the ultimate creation, and part of the ultimate creator, but they have, the next level is actually yogis who meditate on Paramatma within the heart, and then finally the stage of devotee. So there seem to be different kind of levels in there. I asked this question to Chaitanya Charan Prabhu, that there seems to be an intermediate level, like you have, and this seems to be, if you examine the term buddhi, buddhi means intelligence. So depending on one's level of intelligence, and buddhi actually means spiritual intelligence as opposed to the jnani kind of intelligence. So in that way, there's a difference. There's a differentiation that takes place. Good? Yes, Prabhu. Yeah. You perhaps are in the buddhi category, so...
Now, just one example of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya.
Yes. Could you...
Well, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was extremely learned. He was even able to understand that when Lord Chaitanya fell, you know, in ecstasy, he knew the symptoms, and he knew he's not dead. He is in ecstasy. You know, he's going through the symptoms of ecstasy right now. But he was not a devotee.
Yes, he was not a devotee. That is the difference. Yes, Kalyapani Prabhu.
This gentleman's question about if you stop pinda for some time and then resume, I would answer with a question. If you're on life support and you stop it for some time and then change your mind, what happens? The thing is, with material activities, if you don't achieve perfection, then it's a waste.
Ah, yes.
With spiritual activities, may have become an ashasi bhaktivayana vidyata. A little advancement is permanent and for all good,
yeah.
not so with material activities.
Yes. That's often the reason described why karma, kanda activities are not recommended, because if there's any imperfection, then the whole thing is useless.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
What of the category of person who has sort of a pantheistic jnana, a knowledge? They see scriptures that are identical in another tradition, as in this tradition, and they see some of the same things. Are they a mudha, or are they starting to elevate their consciousness to a place that's, you know, it's a little confusing because it can be sort of...
Well, I don't think they're mudha, because mudha indicates that they're not interested, they're simply interested in material activities for sense gratification. So I wouldn't consider someone who is, say, studying Christian scriptures, who sees a similarity with Vaishnava scriptures, as a mudha.
If their knowledge leads them to start to unravel cultural centricity and say they just want to go to God, they don't want to go to some wrappings around God, they just want to go to God.
Yes.
So what of that person? What category is that person in?
This is the category of people that I want to be spiritual, but I don't want a religion. That's their mentality, right? That somehow they see that religion has, organized religion has let people down, so therefore they feel, yeah, but I know that there's got to be something spiritual. I feel that, and I would like that. I would like to be spiritual, but I don't see the way. I don't see that any of these paths are valid. Actually, this is what we say about Krishna consciousness, that if you don't like organized religion, well, come to Yeah, we sometimes joke like that, but yes, you wanted to ask something back there. Yes.
If you could give the answer in a nutshell, there was a TV show a while ago on HBO in which they did regarding Henry VIII, King of England, and in the time in which he was distraught after the loss of his wife, Jane Seymour, he was with his, more or less his court clown, who basically could say anything he wanted to the king and not fear any death. And so they were discussing something, and all of a sudden Henry says, "Go to H-E double toothpicks." Now, he doesn't say it that way, but I'm making it easier. And the clown looked at him and said, "Oh, I thought I was already there." How would a Krishna conscious person respond to that statement?
I didn't quite catch exactly what the king said and what the clown said.
The king basically was having an argument, and he said, "Excuse me, everybody, the quote in the movie is, 'Go to hell.'"
Oh,
and the jester looks at him and says,
I thought I was there.
I was
already there, yes. Well, yes, that is actually our situation in the material world. We understand that, you know, anything short of the spiritual world is a kind of hell, because you're always expecting, you're always hankering, and you're always lamenting. That's the two things. The Buddhists try to get around that, to just be here now, you know, but that doesn't really ring true either, because sometimes you can be in suffering, and sometimes you could be in elation and jubilation, and you know, being here now is that's their attempt at nirvana. You know, try to be non-affected by anything, but that is a negation of our natural desires as spirit souls for Krishna consciousness and for relationship. Actually, it's not really a question of whether what we're doing is positive or negative, or can be seen in positive or negative light, but just that it is for Krishna. It is the relationship with Krishna that is the most important thing. It's just like Bhishma on the battlefield, and he's fighting like anything against Arjuna and Krishna, and he's in ecstasy, you know. And then when Krishna really gets mad, and then he's really in ecstasy, then he's super ecstasy, you know. So this is so it's not so much a question of the what we would term the physical reality of what's going on, or physical interpretation of what's going on, but the relationship that is happening between the Lord and his devotee. That is the most important aspect of our understanding of Krishna consciousness. So what is that? How does that relationship work? So the jester understood his relationship with the king, and understood that he could say those things, and the king could appreciate, so that the king could appreciate. Yes, well, actually, he was, as I recall the story, Henry VIII was in pretty bad shape by that time. It was like grossly obese and grossly in pain, physical pain, from his wounds, from the wounds of his life. And so, in that sense, I'd say he appreciated. Anyone else? Yes, Radha Gopinath Prabhu.
I just had a thought that, you know, Lord Chaitanya left 8 beautiful verses which all deal with humility. And sometimes we get distracted, like you're mentioning, we're kind of going in the direction of all the different paths and avenues, angles of vision for intelligence, you know, like the Maya Prithagyanas, they all get kind of tripped up and caught up in, mm-hmm. in so many different aspects of intelligence. But the person who can, even though they may be coming for material motive to approaching God, they're, in some ways, they're more advanced because they're on the path, they're at the beginning, and so if they can remain humble, that path remains open for them, whereas people who get ahead of themselves, that intelligence...
Absolutely.
The intelligence just trips them up.
Absolutely, and that's why Krishna makes that distinction between the two classes of people, because the two verses are right next to each other. So the people who are approaching him and the people who are rejecting him, they're right there in that same section, just in those two verses. So it is very much like that Krishna is explaining. Well, thank you very much, Krishna, and all glories to Srila Prabhupada.